strange day where we have a record on one side to the plus side and a real down day for the other. A major pullback for the tech stocks, but the Dow still managing to close at a new record high. The NASDAQ having awful luck, an incredible triple-digit plunge.
What an exciting and interesting day on Wall Street, because you really have this divergence. You had some of these financials doing great. You had record highs for the Dow, the NASDAQ, the S&P. But by the end of the day, we saw tech sell off in a big way.
A dramatic tale of two cities here.
The economic data has definitely softened up a little bit, and we've seen investors kind of put on the lower for longer trade.
Congress, the administration's got to get a big tax cut through, or you're going to see this market reflect what happened to tech today.
Every day, we are making progress on our agenda for the country. We can walk and chew gum at the same time.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it was a mixed week for the market. Just about the only thing that was positive this week was the Dow Jones Industrial Average. We had a couple of the major indexes taking a downturn towards the end of the week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Louise Yamada will be joining me. She is somewhat cautious right now, but she still thinks we're in a secular bull market, and she's not very optimistic about commodity. She's going to have a lot to say about all the asset classes. She'll be joining me in Hour 1. Also, Dave Morgan will be joining us here. There are a lot of people predicting that silver is going to hit 50 or maybe go as high as 200. Well, Dave's going to talk about some of the fundamentals driving the silver market. So you're going to want to hear what Dave has to say about both gold and silver. That's coming up in Hour 1, along with Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week. All of that in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. Lots of political theater going on this week. What is really striking is if you understand on one side you have all the political theater, which may or may not go anywhere as far as various conspiracy theories about the Trump administration related to Russia, et cetera, et cetera, and other things that are being investigated as well. There are a number of different investigations going, but all of that aside, you have to recognize that there are major economic issues that are generally not being addressed because we're so busy in this spat that's going on right now that we can't get to them. In addition to everything else, Obamacare needs to be fixed because it's driving insurers out of the marketplace. As Charles Krauthammer said, we're on our way to a single-payer healthcare system on the path in which we're on right now. Number two, we have a hideous debt. We're at $20+ trillion owed by the government. That's going to limit President Trump or any future president, not to mention concentrations of corporate power and government power. We have seen things in the last 20 years that we've never seen before. And it's all being called the new normal. So what does that mean? And that's the subject that we have. You know, does it mean you just give up on it? Or do you say, well, we're going to try to make our way through this? What does it really mean? This whole new normal of everything that we have seen. And we'll address all of that in the big picture today. And then, speaking of all of these oncoming crises, that's what we're going to look at with Dr. Gary Schilling discussing his most recent June Insight newsletter, U.S. debt, government interest costs, the events that might cause a U.S. debt bomb to just go kaboom. And that would take everybody by surprise because they're busy focused on other things. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we do at the beginning of every program, every week, as long as he's here, we go to Ryan Poplava, CEO of Poplava Financial Services, to discuss the market wrap for this week. Well, in the political news, there was no lack of chitter chatter. What can you tell us about the financial markets this week, Ryan?
Yeah, you're right. We definitely did start off politically charged with Saudi Arabia cutting off its ties to Qatar, and then later turned to the Comey investigation Wednesday and Thursday, with markets largely pausing to wait for more information on a possible obstruction of justice. You know, that didn't come, so the markets rallied. But, you know, if you recall the New York Times article on May 17th, that caused the market to have one of the biggest intraday drops this year. Luckily, John, for U.S. stocks, the testimony, like I said, it wasn't irrefutable, indisputable obstruction of justice information against the president. And therefore, you know, we saw a rally early on Friday morning. The other major items this week that were, I would say, catalysts for specific areas of the financial market were the ECB meeting on Thursday and the UK's elections also on Thursday, which, you know, we can talk about a little more later if you'd like.
Yeah, there was sort of red meat out there for all the dogs in the fight. And you could tell that they were all chewing on it as soon as we got done with the testimony.
Some ribeyes, yeah, some fillet.
Yep, exactly. And you just didn't want to put your hand in the middle of it. Okay, let's chalk the former FBI Director Comey's testimony more or less as theatrics this week. It really didn't resolve anything. Okay, so,
and we knew it wouldn't, right? Because
pretty much
he'd
yeah.
be incriminating himself,
right? And I've been talking to the people at Judicial Watch who have done some of the most candid investigation into this, and their response to me was, well, yeah, it's like there's much noise, but it's very difficult to find any substance in the midst of any noise, you know. So anyway, but that served to pause the markets from the advance since the May 17th bottom. Once this was over and it didn't produce any solid evidence, then the market was free to digest other information. But we should point out that President Trump isn't out of the woods yet, because special counsel is conducting its own investigation. So what does that mean? That means the blather is going to go on for quite some time. We're not done with this. We're not anywhere near done with this, even if it all just blows over as a lot of smoke sooner or later, or goes the other way. I mean, there is some indication that there were some connections between Russian banking connections and the Trump clan, shall we say. Okay, let's move on. You mentioned that the ECB meeting last week would be a catalyst. The European Central Bank results are in. What can you tell us about the meeting this week? And especially, I'd like to look at, has anything changed in language or stance?
Yes, actually, language did change. The ECB was expected to really sound a little less dovish overall. So that was the general consensus belief, because the economy has been improving. And so they did. You know, they kept rates steady, but they dropped language from its statement implying that rates could go lower if need be. But during the press conference was where a lot of focus was. Draghi essentially was stating that the risks were balanced for the economic outlook, but also that the economic outlook was expected to improve at a faster pace. But on the flip side, he said inflation, so we got the economy, goals there, and then we got inflation, goals there. He said that the inflation is tame and not likely to pick up near term. And that's an issue for the euro, which dropped for the last few days of trading this week, holding current levels after a nice advance from the April lows. And the reason for that is that the FOMC, you know, the Federal Open Market Committee, and the European Central Bank continue to track very different paths of policy. So the euro weakened despite the improved growth assessment. I think if the ECB, even though they were less dovish in some of their message, if they were a little bit more concerned about this or that on inflation, that could have maybe strengthened the euro more than it already has. But yeah, so the message was a little less dovish, and things have improved in the economy, and no real concern yet on inflation. Inflation is tame.
Okay, well, that sounds fair. And the euro's already had a decent run since March. So now you mentioned the FOMC. They have a policy meeting next week, according to my calendar, correct?
Right, announcing on Wednesday the 14th.
Okay, here we go. The rate hike speculation again. What's the general consensus regarding this? I hate to bring this up again.
The tea leaves.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's it. All right. Last time we spoke about it, though, we assumed that there'd be a dovish hike, you know, sort of a hike with gradual commentary, not really leaning in any direction towards growth or slowdown. So what do you think the consensus is?
You're right. The consensus right now does expect a rate hike. Looking at my notes, I think when we look at the federal funds futures, you know, people actually putting money towards gambling, speculating, another word for it, what will happen, have something like a 95.8% probability that we'll get a rate hike. Generally, when we see probabilities above 90%, it's fairly certain with what investors think is going to happen and what typically does happen at these meetings. It's expected they'll leave their year-end estimates for rates this year at 3 rate hikes. We've already seen one, expecting one next week. So that could leave maybe September or December open. But we could even see four if things change, or see just next week one and done for the whole rest of the year. You know, it all depends. It's all going to fluctuate based on what's going on with the economy. They're data dependent. But what they do with their estimates towards 2018 is up in the air, possibly some language suggesting a surprise that inflation isn't picking up due to the tightness in labor, which has largely been a real enigma. And I definitely suggest investors tune into Janet Yellen's conference call afterward for the main catalysts for what most likely, if the market does make any kind of moves, it'll be based on what Yellen says in that conference.
You know, we forgot to talk about the other catalyst you mentioned this week, the UK elections, which again turned out to be not quite as big as an upset as the Brexit or the Trump election here, but it really got attention. Did that have any effect on trading in the financial markets, given they didn't strengthen the Conservative Party's seats in Parliament?
Yeah, so the consensus when she announced the elections was that their party was strong and could maybe strengthen their foothold in Parliament. And, you know, even the consensus I was reading yesterday from trading desks was saying that they expected the Conservative Party to get a majority, but that didn't really happen. It didn't really affect the world market, but it definitely did the UK's market. The pound corrected because traders were assuming there will be more political uncertainty now and a challenge for the Conservatives to navigate through Brexit than if they would have had, you know, more certainty, more seats to have a clear majority. However, the FTSE stock index rallied on the weak euro and what it could do for exports. So, but it was largely, you know, honed in on just their markets.
Well, anything else that we should highlight that happened this week that we might especially have not noticed in all of the brouhaha?
I like to add some little technical notes every now and then each week, just because that's one of my strengths. But anybody investing in the markets had to have noticed big time on Friday the correction in technology stocks. You know, the Nasdaq took quite a jab on the face on Friday, down 1.8%. And it looks like there was quite the rotational trade out of tech, semiconductors, internet, very big mega super cap stocks were really what were leading on the downside. And I think that brought kind of everyone with it in those groups. So out of these growth areas and into areas that haven't been moving up, like energy and financials, which have been just dogs, financials are actually having a decent June so far, probably as yields are starting to anticipate, I think, maybe a hike next week from the Fed. And given the Comey testimony didn't incriminate Trump, you know, recall yields jumped a lot after Trump was elected on reflationary expectations, those three areas that we talk about every week. Since March, that has simmered down because we saw that the Republicans struggled to get their initial bill through on healthcare and finally did get it through the second time. You know, Friday, I think, was a positioning and sentiment day with money rotating. And, you know, we had Didier Sornay on the Insider Show with Chris Sheridan on May 18th. And using his models, he stated there were many large tech mega cap companies showing positive bubble signs with weak fundamentals based on his models. And that was somewhat prescient towards today's trading, as that must be what really triggered the rotation. Although I did some further research and notes, and I did see later on in the wires that Goldman Sachs had highlighted, you know, a number of large mega cap companies. You know, we talk about the Fabulous Five, which had significantly contributed to the market's multi-month rally recently, maybe overextended. An analyst at Goldman Sachs said this performance, driven by secular growth and the death of the reflation narrative, I don't know about so much about that, but pretty close, has created positioning extremes and factor crowding and difficult to decipher risk narratives. So anyways, a big note from Goldman Sachs, and that could have been the actual trigger. I'm not sure exactly. I just know technically money moved out of tech and other growth areas and moved into energy and financials.
All right, Ryan, it is a good time to be in news, as I've always said. A lot to talk about and interesting future here. So we'll have you join us again next week. And aside from FOMC, I'm not sure what else might be coming up.
That's really just it. I think there's some economic numbers. I think CPI and retail. So we can talk a little bit more about economics, maybe get a general consensus of what's going on since the first quarter. If there isn't anything else to talk about but the FOMC, I'll take a look at those numbers.
Okay, Ryan, good weekend.
Sure thing, you too, John, and our listeners.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The employment report last week was largely noise. I mean, of course, the payroll number came in at 138,000 rise on the month, which is not a terribly weak number anyway. I mean, over the long haul, it's actually more than enough to meet labor force growth, but it's a bit weaker than the trend recently, which has been 180,000 plus per month. We look at other related numbers, including jobless claims, which remain basically near their lowest since 1973. There's absolutely no sign of a turn in those numbers. So, I mean, my takeaway from all this is that there's no significant change in the trend in employment growth. So pretty steadily, the unemployment rate's been coming down. Of course, it was 10% at the peak after the recession, but it's been coming down and down and down. And frankly, I don't see the slowing in employment growth that will be needed to stop that downtrend. So I expect the unemployment rate to keep on falling, and we'll probably have a three-handle, a sub-4% number by next year.
The stock market, to the surprise of many, has been hitting one record after another in some things that we haven't seen before. An all-time record for the NASDAQ, but also an all-time record for utilities. What does this mean for investors? Joining us from LY Advisors is Louise Yamada. Louise, let's begin with the Dow Industrials, one of the oldest theories of technical analysis followed by the markets. We have the Dow breaking out to new record levels, but the transports seem to be having difficulty. Does that mean anything of significance technically?
Well, it does leave us with a little bit of cautionary feeling, because the Dow theory is such that the companies that make the goods and the companies that transport the goods are supposed to move in the same direction. And granted, we, you know, have different types of transport today with the drones coming online, but nevertheless, it has been a little bit problematic. And as of last week, it looked as though the transports were trying to come up through the consolidation, but it hasn't succeeded yet as of today. So yes, it does leave us with a little bit of pause. It would be considered a non-confirmation that the Dow has gone off to new highs, but the transports have not yet confirmed. And generally, when that happens, if it continues, it's a warning for some kind of a market setback. It doesn't have to be a major setback, but in many cases it has been. So we're looking, watching the transports, hoping that they might get through 9,600. That would be the breakout from this six-month consolidation.
Yeah, you bring up something that's rather interesting. You know, the Dow theory started out with the transports, which at one time was mainly the railroads. And then, of course, we had the Dow Industrials. If you look at the Dow Industrials today, we have technology companies, we have drug companies, we have retail companies, and certainly in the transports, we have airlines, trucking companies. Now you talk about drones delivery, and I just read an article that they're actually talking about driverless cars that will be making delivery. So you wonder if some of these indexes, Louise, I guess, have as much relevance as they used to, because so much of our economy has changed.
Yes, that's certainly a question that we ask. You always get into a little trouble saying, you know, is it different this time? But there are certainly a lot of things about it that are different.
And speaking of things that are different, I want to talk about what we're seeing in the market. We're seeing a breakout of the NASDAQ. Technology has been on fire, and I want to get to some of these technology stocks. But Louise, we're also seeing the Dow utilities break out to records we haven't seen before. What does that tell you?
Well, generally, the utilities have been considered a defensive sector, and obviously with very low interest rates in terms of treasuries and other corporate yields, the utilities have provided a nice income. But we've had a question out there for over a decade as to whether or not the utilities could be considered the basic materials for the new high-tech environment. You have to have electricity to keep the cloud cool. I mean, you can talk about all this stuff being in the cloud, but basically it's in a place where they keep the records, and it has to be kept cool. And that, of course, reflects on utilities. But I think the other thing that's really fascinating to me, the more I read, particularly there in California, is that the utilities are really starting to utilize wind and solar and trying to find new ways of storing in batteries, and perhaps are moving to the point where someday in the next decade they'll actually be profitable.
Yeah, one thing that we see here in Southern California, because we get so much sunshine, is almost every new housing development that you see has solar options. And, you know, my house is solar powered. And certainly even in some of the other neighborhoods around town, solar is becoming ubiquitous in California. And also you're seeing more and more electric cars and hybrid cars, to the point where the government here in California is now passing a special tax because they're losing revenues on gasoline because more people are driving either electric cars or hybrid cars.
Well, that's really interesting. We don't see quite that much of it in New York, but I think it's rather exciting to see more and more electric cars, or at least the hybrids. I enjoyed driving one at one point when we rented. Of course, in New York, I don't keep a car, but we rent. And I think that the other aspect of all of this in terms of alternate energy is affecting oil, which is looking really weak.
On the day you and I are speaking, inventory levels came out. They were expecting a drawdown for 10 weeks in a row instead. Inventory levels actually increased. Let's diverge there and talk about commodities in general. You have gold close to 1,300, and you have oil. Looks like it could be heading to 4,500 or below. What's your take on commodities here?
Well, the commodities, as we look at it from the CCI index, if you wanted to just take a long picture, looks a lot like oil. It's still under the 2011 downtrend, the overall commodity index. It's broken a support here that's been in place since 2016. And I don't think the bear market's over yet for commodities, or at least if they don't go to a new low, which is just above 350 on the CCI, if they don't go to a new low, they at least have a long period of repair and consolidation ahead. But I think that there's a lot to be said for the fact that they don't look as though they want to turn up into a new structural bull market anytime soon. And, you know, I don't know, Jim, to what degree this could be a factor in that a lot of the large banks have closed their commodity trading desks so that there's a lot less speculation. I'm not saying there's no speculation, but there's a lot less than there was in the heyday of all the traders.
And speaking of speculation, I want to talk about another subject matter. If you look at passive indexing today, which has become very popular, that passive indexing has led to large valuations in a small group of stocks. For example, if you buy a index fund in the NASDAQ, over 11% of it is going to go into Amazon. Louise, let's talk about some of the valuations of some of these stocks like Amazon, Netflix, that are selling at 200 times earnings. Some of these stocks have valuations that are reminiscent of the tech bubble.
Yeah, that's a little frightening. I'm just looking at Amazon, PE of 150, and I guess not a lot of earnings, which is exactly what happened in 1999-2000. A lot of those technology stocks really had no earnings to speak of. I would say, however, that a lot of what's happening in some of these, if you want to call them overvalued areas, is that they are definitely looking like they are going to become, you know, part of the new, I would say technology today is probably going to be considered the new industrial sector, so to speak. It's just pretty amazing, but I agree with you, and we put some pictures in our latest publication showing the parabolic levels that some of these stocks, the FANG stocks and some of the other technology stocks, have moved to. And that's a little bit unsettling. I would say if you own them, move your stop losses up, keep moving them along with the price, because parabolics can go on for a long time. But when they reverse, they don't do it by going sideways. They generally go down.
I want to talk about another area of the market, and I know you follow the international markets, and for the longest time, the U.S. had the top performing market in the world. But in 2017, we've seen the breakout in the international markets. I wonder if you can address international stocks right now and what you see in the charts.
Well, they have been looking much better. There's no question about it. You have new highs in a lot of the global market, not across the board, but certainly in quite a few of them. And the developed markets in particular have broken out through their 2014 downtrend. The emerging markets are still struggling a little bit at the 211 downtrend, but they're definitely improving. We've seen new highs, and certainly in the FTSE, you've got a reaction high in the French market. Germany's at a new high. You have India at a new high, and it's very impressive.
I want to move on to another sector of the market, and that's interest rates. We've seen, despite two Fed rate increases, and another one is expected this month, we've seen 10-year treasuries come down. You and I believe that, I think, that we have entered a long-term secular bear market for bonds, which can play out over several decades. But I wonder if you might comment about the recent drop in yields on 10-year treasuries, given the fact that the Fed is more likely to raise interest rates for the third time this month.
Yes, indeed. I'd actually comment also on the two-year, which I think is looking much more prepared to move higher right away. The 10-year did break its slight 2016 uptrend, and we have a potential. It could still come down to 2% and be perfectly normal within a consolidation that could eventually turn up. I'm not sure exactly what's taking the 10-year down at this point, but the two-year is actually at 1.30 today, which is well within this six-month consolidation that both of the yields have been enjoying. So I think ultimately we'll see rates move up in the 10-year, but I think at the moment the two-year is the canary in the mine, and it's telling us that rates look as though they want to resolve on the upside. But I don't think that necessarily, because technology, I think, reduces to a certain extent the potential for inflation. And if you talk about wage inflation, you hear that maybe there's a little bit more, but when we have so much being replaced, so many workers being replaced with robots, you certainly don't have a wage consideration if you have a factory that's being conducted with robotic workers, so to speak. So I think that our inflation rate has continued to go up in what I've called the essentials, whether it's healthcare, food, etc. I don't think we're going to see it where we have normally seen inflation come to the fore. So rates could go up at a much slower rate for a period of years.
Recently, I have started to read the fourth edition of A History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer. And something that really struck me out reading the book this time, Louise, is that for the longest period of time, you would have to go back to, let's say, Hammurabi to find interest rates at 20%, which we saw in the 70s. So basically, in our working careers, in yours and mine, we have seen two anomalies that we have not seen in history in 5,000 years. A high of interest rates of 20% in the 70s, and then last summer, the lowest interest rates we've seen in recorded human history. We truly have lived in the last four decades in an extraordinary time.
That's a very interesting observation. I have the book. I have not looked at it in a while. It'd be worth a reread, definitely. But yes, we went to a new low even versus the last falling rate cycle, which was into 1946 when rates finally started the rise that took us into 1981.
Louise, as you look at this market right now, you have a lot of the sectors breaking out with obviously utilities leading and also with technology, but some danger there because, as we talked earlier, the transports are not confirming the highs in the industrials, which would imply some sort of caution. The other side of caution is on the technology stocks. Some of these Fab Five stocks are at nosebleed levels. They almost look parabolic with PE ratios that are reminiscent of the late 1990s. Given this kind of background and the fact that the Fed is still raising interest rates, and this reminds me of the old adage from Edson Gould, three steps and a stumble, could we be heading for a stumble here?
It's possible. We did a study on Edson Gould's work years back, And one of the things that came to the fore is that it may not stumble with the third rate if you're in an entrenched bull market. And of course, if we think we are, which we certainly have had technical arguments to suggest, then perhaps it'll take 4 or 5 or 6 interest rate rises to affect a stumble in the stock market that could be considered due to the rise in interest rates. The other side of the coin is interest rates are so very low that it may not have the same effect at very low levels, just raising it within these very low levels for a period of time. But that is definitely a consideration, the three steps and stumble.
So what I'm hearing, Louise, is a bit of caution on your part, given where the markets are in typically, I'm saying typically, it doesn't always happen this way. Stock markets tend to find a weak period during the summer. It's like sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. But that hasn't exactly played out over the last couple of years. From a technical perspective, in the things that you're looking at now, what would you be doing as an investor?
I would inject a little caution, which is what we just said in our report. Definitely, I would raise stop loss levels. I would respect support breaks as in if stocks begin to stumble and break down. I would be careful of any stock that starts putting in place lower highs because that can be the evolution of a topping process. And apart from that, I certainly wouldn't chase stocks that are in these parabolic rates and just be careful and protect oneself that way. Remember, it never hurts to take some profits off the table. And if we preserve our capital, we have it available in the event that lower prices come to the fore.
A final question, if I may. If there was something that would begin to alert you or cause you concern about the markets in a topping process or real danger ahead, what would that be?
Well, it's usually a series of divergences that we see in our indicators, and we are not without those divergences now. We have a series of lower highs in the new high versus new lows over a year, which is something that we watch that generally can run even longer than a year. But one of the things that's particularly problematic is that our volume momentum, which is a proprietary calculation of rising volume to falling volume, has not really expanded during this final rise, I would say, or the rise that's been taking place in the markets. It's fine for the NASDAQ. It's confirming with rising volume. But the New York Stock Exchange measure of our volume momentum has been flirting above and below the zero line. And one would think that if this advance really had the potential behind it to continue, you would see the elimination of the one-year divergence that's in place for the rising volume versus the declining volume. So right now, they're about equal, and that isn't a strong, strong sign. But we aren't going to throw caution to the wind here. We will watch everything carefully and see where these things take us. On the other hand, the cumulative advance decline line has been confirming the rises. There are a few times in history when it has not given us the 4 to 6 month divergence that it has generally, but there are some reasons here to at least keep an eye on one's investments.
And, you know, just a final observation, you know, we saw the stock markets take off after the election of Donald Trump, something that wasn't anticipated. In fact, the night before, the Dow futures were down 800 points. Louise, a lot of that was based on certain things getting done, from the repeal of Obamacare, tax cuts, infrastructure spending. It doesn't seem like any of that is going on. The parties are fighting each other. You got the press fighting the president fighting himself, the Republicans divided. It doesn't seem like a lot of the promise or a lot of the expectations that the markets were going on seem to be coming to fruition, given almost this gridlock and constant infighting in Washington. Is it possible when the market wakes up that maybe some of these things are not going to get done in the time thought that we could have a more serious correction?
I think that's a valid consideration. It's certainly a valid concern. And if you think about the small caps, the Russell 2000, the mid caps, they really have retained a 6 month consolidation. They have not broken out yet. You know, we saw some broadening out coming. The 400, I think, tried to move to a slight new high, and it looked encouraging. But basically, they're not moving with the same drama or dramatic advance that the S&P and the NASDAQ are. And yeah, I think it's too bad they tried to tackle probably the biggest problem first, which was health care. I think the tax laws that would have allowed corporations to bring money back into this country would have been much wiser to have addressed that immediately, because that would have helped with the whole concept of jobs and infrastructure and letting some of the manufacturing activity come back here. But you're right, it's disappointing. And there was a very interesting article on the Smoot-Hawley Act back in the early part of the century, where the tariffs that were put on really caused the secondary decline in the 1932 bear market. And I would be very hesitant to consider any tariffs that he'd been talking about as being beneficial to any degree, and that would be a worrisome concern, something everyone should keep an eye on.
Louise, as we close, I wonder if you might tell our listeners about your retail newsletter. You cover a lot of extensive markets, the major markets, the international markets, from ETFs and interest rates, but you also have an educational component that comes out each month. It's one of my favorite letters to read. I wonder if you might tell our listeners about that, if you would.
Thank you, Jim. It's very kind of you. Yes, all one needs to do is Google my name, and you can go to info@LYAdvisors. It's shown right there on the website, and I would be happy to send you details and a sample. It does cover all the markets, commodities, interest rates, and as you said, occasionally an educational piece. So we'd be happy to show it to anyone who'd like to see it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Dan Buettner. He's author of The Blue Zone, 9 Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who Have Lived the Longest. Dan, I wonder if you'd give us a little bit of a background of how this book came about in the study of people that live well into their hundreds.
Well, I developed a knack for solving great mysteries, unraveling great mysteries, and spent about 8 years with teams of scientists to figure out why the ancient Maya civilization collapsed and if Marco Polo went to China and why the Anasazi disappeared. And in 2000, we came across a very interesting study from the World Health Organization that showed that women from Okinawa, southern Japan, have the highest disability-free life expectancy in the world. In other words, they live the longest, healthiest life. And I said, aha, now there's a great mystery. And I assembled a team, and we did a cursory expedition there and came back and packaged our findings, made a grant to the National Institutes on Aging, got a grant to do the demographic work to see if we could find other pockets where people live the longest, and then a big assignment from National Geographic to see if we could figure out what explains longevity in pockets around the world where people live the longest. We call them blue zones areas.
Well, here we are on Friday with gold and precious metals heading up, at least for this week. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, let's begin and take a look at both silver and gold. It seems like we have this kind of narrow trading range that we've been in here over the last 12 months. You know, silver got as high as $21, and here we are on this Friday, we're a little over $17, and gold has been struggling to try to get over 1300. So I'd like to begin, give me your take, because this is typically that time of the year, seasonality wise, where metals tend to be weak, but we've got a little strength going here. So what's your take?
Well, my take, Jim, is we may not see the normal seasonality, which means we may be like last year, where actually silver and gold did well in the summer months. And technically, we're at a very interesting point in time for the gold market, which means that the 6-year downtrend, taking it from the September high of 2011 and drawing a line down, very the basic technical analysis you can make, was ready or perched to make a breakout about 2 days ago. And you can see guys on the web that have said it or broke through. From my chart work, it didn't. But regardless, if it did or it didn't follow through. I have what's called the Morgan rule, which is a three-day rule, which means you've got to get through a point of resistance on good volume, and it has to maintain that for 3 days in a row. That did not take place as we're doing your program. Which means to me that we're probably going to continue in a broad range for both the metals.
So when you see something like this, where you're in this kind of range bound, I guess, Dave, seasonality wise, we always know the fall and the first part of the year is a strong time for metals. But is there anything out there that's a catalyst? I mean, nobody anticipated that the stock market would take off in the way it did on the election of Donald Trump. But, you know, if he gets a lot of his stimulus programs, whether it's infrastructure spending of $1 trillion or tax cuts, that's going to be very stimulative for the economy. Do you see anything on the horizon that would be a catalyst for the metals?
Well, Jim, to come right back to you, I mean, you're the one that wrote Silver Waiting for a Catalyst, and I do. I think there's three areas. One is the industrial side. Silver still has the qualities that no other metal has, at least on an economic perspective, which means it has the best reflectivity, the best conductivity, the best heat transfer capabilities, and then actually some acoustic qualities that no other metal has. And the ones that come close are far more expensive, platinum, palladium, and even gold. So that's one, and there is a possibility of what, and I'm going to go out there a bit, Jim, but, you know, I look at a lot of things this WebBot program looks at, which is future linguistic programming, where it's seeing the quote unquote, in quotation marks, new electrics, whatever that means. But there is a possibility or high potential, I won't say high, but medium potential for some type of technology that requires silver. Certainly, I know from my work that the requirement for silver is key in the nanotechnology field. However, we're talking nanotechnology. We're not talking vast quantities of silver. But that's one, is the industrial side. The second is the monetary side. And that is where the bulwark of the gold and silver investors are basically 45 years and older. They're basically burnt out on this market. Hopefully they only have about a 10, at the most 20% exposure, which is what I teach. And they're, you know, making money in, you know, the stock market and other areas, because certainly that has always been my foundational argument, that is, whatever happens to the economy, you need a hedge position, but that's all you need. So as the millennials become wealthier and more attuned to, let's say, the macro picture, which you've done such an excellent job over the years, there could be, and I believe there will be, some move from, let's say, these speculative investments that many of them are doing now, seeking safer ideas, which, of course, includes the metals, especially if you look at where we are on the commodity cycle versus the stock market generally. We're at about a 50-year low. So it's a ratio trade. It's one that I'm very familiar with, and I think it's a good one for the millennials. So we need new buyers. So that's the other one. So you've got the monetary side and the industrial side. And the last one is technology, not just technology for the industrial side, but technology in general. You never know what is going to come out of, let's say, the crypto valley in the future.
You know, this really strikes me because, I mean, we live in this complex technological world today. I mean, if you take a look at the devices we have, I mean, our personal phones, our smartphones are almost like personal computers, whether you have tablets, all the various devices, smart homes, or even if you take a look at solar. I mean, in Southern California now, it is not unusual where you go to a new housing development and one of the options on the home is solar. More and more homes are using solar. I know I have a solar powered home in my neighborhood. I would say over half the homes are powered by solar. So as we get more technologically oriented, doesn't this create a demand for silver in many ways in comparison to gold?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to digress here, but I want to make the point. At the last Silver and Gold Summit in San Francisco last November, of course, I listened to as many, you know, interviews as I could, or many presentations, I should say. And one of the best was definitely from Jeff Christian. And he went through the financial spectrum, speaking to the fact that if you look at all financial assets, ex real estate, so we're only talking basically stocks, bonds, limited master partnerships, basically anything you find on the stock market, options, ETFs, Gold physically represents 1% of the entire financial system on a global basis, but silver represents 0.02%. So you can see how tiny the market is relative to the financial markets in general, and specifically even relative to the gold market. So if you have a double pressure, meaning you've got technology use that has to use silver because economically it's the cheapest way to go and most efficient, and you have new buyers coming to the market, you've got a twofold increase in demand. And industrial-wise, in most cases, it's price inelastic, which we've talked about before, which means if you're putting out a $500 item and silver represents 1%, or let's say 0.1%, which is more accurate, of the cost of that item, and silver goes up 10 times, it still only represents 1% of the overall cost of the item. And so it's really meaningless in most applications. Now, that's not true in silverware or jewelry. I get that. I'm talking about industrial applications like a solar panel. Solar panels need silver. And they've been squeezed, meaning they've been what the Silver Institute loves to call thrifted. It's a London word. But they use it as efficiently as possible. So if we had the same amount of silver per panel that we had in 2010, in 2017, the offtake of silver, Jim, wouldn't be 70 million ounces a year. It'd be the 140 million ounces a year that Jessica Cross had forecast very early on. But the efficiencies have gotten better and better. And that's the way a real economy, a physical economy works. You want to get as much profit and better margins based on any way you can do it. The best way to do it is, how much silver do we really need per panel? And that's been squeezed down to about half of what it was just about 7-8 years ago.
So outside of industrial use, and I guess, you know, if you take a look at the last decade, it was not only industrial use, is a lot of these modern appliances that we use today, our cell phones, our tablets, even the advancement of solar came in. But Dave, it was a tremendous boom in emerging markets that drove this demand for precious metals. It was a big catalyst. I want to move aside from that and then move over and talk about the gold and silver equities for a moment, because I've never been really impressed with the way these companies manage their business. They over-dilute shareholders. They're not astute on their purchases. But during the downturn, a lot of these companies went out of business, especially on the silver producer side. And I think jokingly, you mentioned to me that some of these companies that used to produce silver are now producing marijuana. So maybe they're making money. But let's talk about the industry itself, because it's contracted. It's not producing as much. What is the outlook, in your opinion, for these equities? Because I think about the only profitable area that I've seen with these companies have been the royalty companies.
Exactly. And to plug the Morgan Report, as you know, Jim, since you get my work, that's why we still have some of our initial investment up, you know, 600, 700, 900% in some cases. The 900 is royal gold. And that's why I specialize in that sector, because I agree that most of this industry doesn't really know how to do well from a business perspective, whereas basically a mining finance house does. They are not that concerned with what the price oscillations in the precious metals are. They're concerned with getting a royalty or a stream or both that is advantageous to both sides. And these are the companies that, as you know, we've done a lot with. I do think there's opportunities in the rebalancing of the GDXJ. At the end of 2015, there was $1 billion committed to that ETF. At the end of 2016, it was $5 billion by SEC rules. They had overinvested in many of these companies. When all shakes out and people take advantage of these shakeouts because they have to rebalance, which means selling pressure in a lot of these shares, and we went through that in the last report, you will have the GDXJ looking very much like the GDX. You're not going to see many juniors that are in the GDXJ because they can't. There's so much money available, and some of these small companies are so teeny that the investment takes them beyond the 19.9% that they're allowed to invest.
So if that is changing, as we look at where it is right now, I mean, the GDX has been very much following what we're seeing happening with silver and gold. What about, let's say, metals demand? I have talked to a lot of dealers, and they said, you know, with the downturn, which has lasted 4 years, and really silver and gold not going much of anywhere, and then, you know, you turn on the news every single day. What are you hearing? The Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ is hitting new records. What do you hear talking to the bullion dealers? What are they telling you right now? Are people buying? Or are they just sitting pat? Are they adding to positions or basically doing nothing?
It's flat to down. Almost everybody that's aware of the sector, meaning, you know, from the young college student that, you know, is kind of awake and aware to the gray hairs and everybody in between. It's mostly the older adults. And, you know, my business is primarily business owners, but they're burnt out and they have all they need. They have all they want. They don't want to buy anymore. So the retail market is actually very, very slow right now. There is a caveat to that, Jim, if I can say it. And that is that some of these retail dealers that'll accept cryptocurrency are seeing demand from that and that side only. In other words, not a normal transaction, we'll call it, when it's not abnormal, but they're taking crypto for metals purchases. But it's flat to down.
So it's down in a general sense. You know, the amazing thing, and Dave, you can remember this because you were on the program at the time, but if you take a look at 2011, silver in April of that year hitting close to $50, and then gold in September hitting $1,900. It was the biggest period of not only stock buying of precious metal stocks, but also precious metals. It's very similar to what you see happen psychologically in the stock market. When you see Amazon hit $1,000 a share or Alphabet $1,000 a share, people get really excited at close to the peaks, which is exactly what happened in the precious metals market.
Precisely. I mean, if there's one thing I joke about this that you can say about me at the end is that people love cheap stocks and that they don't buy lows. I mean, it was really frustrating in the beginning when silver was on an adjusted basis was at the lowest price in all of recorded history, and yet no one bought it. Yet, having said that, there were some buyers. There was Warren Buffett buying at the inflation adjusted low. There was Bill Gates buying through a hedge fund, buying a great deal of Pan American Silver, and George Soros started Apex Silver. So it wasn't the millionaires, it was the billionaires that had the smart money and the foresight to see silver was at a very low. But the retail market and even the money managers or hedge funds and all that, they had nothing to do with the silver market. And of course, as you said, you know, once silver got above 30, I got a little bit weary with how hard this move would go and how long it would go. And I actually called the top there. And of course, many people at the time were telling me how wrong I was. It was a lead pipe cinch to go to 100 and I'd lose my reputation and on and on. I go, well, I do my own work. I call them as I see them. And it didn't take long, more than like a week, where that turned out to be the top. And silver consolidated around a $30 level for almost a year. So I thought, you know, maybe, just maybe this time it'll be different, meaning that it will have a big enough margin where a lot of these silver companies could really do well and put those profits back into the ground or expand or whatever, because the margins were good for everybody that was a producer at that time. Not what happened. We had a $26 floor, hit it three times and bounced up. I saw it coming and I put out an alert to our website members that it was going to breach the $26 level, on who knew what would happen after that. But I suspected we're going to have a really bad bear market. And that's exactly what happened. Of course, a few of the hedgies that follow my work were extremely grateful because they were believers like me. And they saw, you know, the honest Dave saying, look, I'm sorry to report this, but here's the deal. 26, it's going to psychologically mess with the market probably for years to come. And it has. I mean, if you get looking at the chart and look at what the demand's been, the true believers certainly have bought all the way down. But nonetheless, the psychology of silver and gold are being a great investment happened when silver breached 26 and at the same time gold breached 1550 to the downside. And it hasn't been the same since.
Okay. As we close, Dave, you recently attended a conference of newsletter writers. I wonder if you might just inform our listeners anything that came out of that conference that you thought was significant you would like to share.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of very interesting companies I'll be reporting about. But overall, the mood was good. I thought that, you know, there is still energy in the sector. There's always new ideas. There's always a lot of enthusiasm that precedes, let's say, the next up move. And I'm not predicting that. I really don't know at this point. But what I do know that investing in a company is different than investing in just the metal itself. And I saw very many interesting situations at the conference.
So, Dave, any parting thoughts as we close, as you look ahead in the second half of the year?
Yes, Jim. One is this sector is one of the most volatile out there. And I've always taught, you know, 10% is probably enough for most people. And there are a lot of situations that surround this sector you have to be very, very careful about. And that's why I wrote 10 Rules of Silver Investing. And I put it in the public domain, basically as a public service announcement. So anyone that is in the sector, you might want to review that, or someone that's thinking about coming to the sector, just Google the 10 Rules of Silver Investing, David Morgan, and that will pop right up. I did videos on it, so you can hear it, you know, verbally from me, and it's in written form in several places on the web. And the main idea is just be very careful with who you deal with. There are situations where I have had phone calls over the years, emails as well, talking about situations that were less than advantageous to the investor. So if you follow the rules that I set out, again, they're for free. And last thing I'd like to mention, a shameless plug, is I started podcasting recently and starting to get some momentum. So if you're inclined to listen to podcasts or download them on your commute, it's The Morgan Report. Just go to iTunes, type in The Morgan Report. And if you're on an Android, just go to Google and type in The Morgan Report podcast. And I guess you can figure out how to get it on an Android.
The last 17 years, we have seen things that, well, we have sort of not seen before. First attack on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor. We've seen the spread of terrorism beyond the Middle East, to Europe, Japan, Australia, bursting of the tech and the housing bubbles, worst financial recession since 1929, and money printing at a level we've never seen before in history, or the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded human history. Concentrations of power. In a few hands, both in the private sector and in the public sector, power and money. What does all of this mean anyway? How does this all come together? Because it's something everybody is calling the new normal. And this is the environment in which we're going to continue functioning. It's actually abnormal, but it's the new abnormal, which is normally abnormal, I guess. That's sort of the logic on the whole thing. And then also coming up in the next hour, Jim will be interviewing Dr. Gary Schilling on the U.S. debt bomb and financial shocks, which may be heading our way. All of that on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.